Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, welcome to Sphinx Radio, and could you give us a breakdown of your work?
Well, that's a tough one. What I think we're referring to is my work in Egypt primarily.
Right.
I first got involved in Egypt in about 1990, actually 1989 or so, through meeting John Anthony West. Before that, I was doing primarily work in various parts of the world, but strictly geological work, should we say, because my PhD is in geology and geophysics. I'd always had some interest in ancient cultures and civilizations, and in many ways it was renewed about 1990 when I first went to Egypt with John Anthony West. And the reason I was invited over there on his behalf was to look specifically at the Great Sphinx and, as a geologist, see if I could say something about the Sphinx in terms of how old it might be based on geological data. And this then evolved and blossomed into my work in Egypt, which initially focused on the Sphinx, has since progressed to the pyramids, to temples, to other aspects of ancient Egypt, and from there has really progressed to looking at civilizations around the world, always, I would say, with a sort of geological eye in terms of how do these civilizations interact with, or how did they interact with the natural environment, with things like maybe natural catastrophes, be they volcanoes, be they cometary, be they earthquakes. So I've just really become fascinated with the interplay between my own field of expertise, geology and geophysics, and how we can use that to look at ancient civilizations.
Now, you were in a bit of a controversy concerning the age of the Sphinx. Could you give us a breakdown of that?
Sure. That's really what I guess I first became known for in this field, and many people still think of me that way, and it's an active interest of mine. The Sphinx, to say briefly, is traditionally considered to have been built or carved as one solid piece, as a magnificent sculpture around 2500 BC by the pharaoh Khafre, or also known as Chephron, depending on how you want to pronounce the name. The traditional story is he ordered it carved about 2500 BC on the Giza Plateau, basically end of story. Yes, it was used later by the New Kingdom Egyptian and the Egyptians in the late period Egyptians, but until I looked at it, few people took seriously the suggestion, which had been circulated, the suggestion that maybe the Sphinx was older than 2500 BC. This is a suggestion that actually goes back to the 19th century. When you look at some of the 19th century Egyptologists, they suggested that just sort of based on casual observation, it looked like the Sphinx might be older than the pyramids. No one ever really followed up on that systematically. A fellow named Schwaller de Lubitsch also suggested that in his work in the 1950s, 1960s. John Anthony West, my friend and colleague, is an expert on Schwaller de Lubitsch, the Egyptologist, philosopher Schwaller de Lubitsch, and he picked up on this and contacted me through intermediaries as a geologist who might come and actually look at the Sphinx systematically, scientifically, and see if there might be something to this theory that the Sphinx could be older than 2500 BC. I went over to Egypt with very skeptical eyes, should we say. I assumed that my academic colleagues knew what they were talking about, my Egyptological colleagues, because I myself am an academic. I've been teaching at Boston University now for 20 years. And I felt pretty confident that there must be some simple explanation and that the traditional dating would, in fact, be vindicated. Much to my surprise, as I looked at it more and more geologically, the weathering features, in particular the erosional features I saw in the core body of the Sphinx, did not make sense in terms of a 2500 BC date. What I found is that the weathering and erosion really harkens back to a much earlier period. People probably know that the Sphinx sits on the edge of the Sahara Desert. It's been ultra arid, hyper-arid, for the last approximately 5,000 years. And what you see on the Sphinx is erosional and weathering features that are incompatible with such a dry, arid climate. They actually harken back to a wetter period. So that was the first inkling I had that, in fact, maybe something was wrong with the traditional dating.
And when you looked at the Sphinx itself, there were certain watermarks, is that correct?
Exactly. What I found on the Sphinx, looking at the body of the Sphinx, and more concretely, because they've had less damage to them over the years, the walls of what's known as the Sphinx enclosure. If people who have not been to Egypt have not seen the Sphinx firsthand, often they think the Sphinx sits up sort of on a hill or on the plateau by its lonely self. It doesn't. It actually sits in what's known as the Sphinx enclosure, or sometimes the Sphinx ditch, because to carve the body, the ancients had to cut down into the bedrock. So it actually sits in this hollow, or it almost looks like a quarry, and it sits there. So the walls of this enclosure actually preserve even better the ancient erosional features, the ancient weathering features, which you also see on the body of the Sphinx. But the body of the Sphinx has been repaired over the millennia, so some of the features are a little bit more difficult to make out on the body. Looking at both of the body and the walls of the enclosure, what I found was very clear, definitive signs of what we can call water weathering, or rain precipitation-induced weathering and erosion, very different than what you expect in a hyper-arid desert climate. So immediately, after thinking about it, at least within a few days, I realized this was just not compatible with the traditional dating, that this weathering had to occur before the onset of the full-fledged Sahara Desert, and that would push us back into the period of pre-dynastic time, pre-3000 BC, at a time period when, according to traditional Egyptologists and traditional archaeologists, no one had the wherewithal or technical ability to construct a Sphinx-type structure.
Now that brings us to the A word, Atlantis.
Yeah, the A word. I will say Atlantis nowadays, and after all these years. Back then, I would not even say the word Atlantis, because the word Atlantis conjures up all kinds of associations and semi-religious, almost, connotations for certain people. It's a real lightning rod for many academics. So I felt it was just best to avoid it. But even now, I hate to jump to Atlantis.
No, really? You say a pre-Icelandic civilization?
Or? Well, I mean, you know, what I will say to finish the story about the Sphinx,
sure,
is that what I found was that the body of the Sphinx, not the entire Sphinx, and I want to stress that, the core body, what I call the core body of the Sphinx, shows evidence of pre-dynastic activity. It was carved in pre-dynastic times. Looking at the Sphinx further, on that first trip and subsequent trips, I've been there many, many times now, it's clear to me that the core body of the Sphinx was carved out. I don't know what the original head was, but the head that's on the Sphinx now is not the original head. That's a recarving from, I believe, early dynastic times. It's been heavily repaired. It's been heavily modified. So you've got the structure where the core structure goes back, by my dating, to approximately 5 to 7,000 BC at least. And then it's been modified, heavily modified since. And one way, I just want to mention really quickly, one way I got the more precise dating is that I also went over there on one trip with a fellow named Tom DeBecky, who's a geophysicist. I'm a geologist and geophysicist. He's a strict geophysicist. We did seismic work around the Sphinx so we could look at subsurface weathering, and I could use that to calibrate a minimum date for the oldest portion of the Sphinx. Because the weathering, you know, you get more and more subsurface weathering as something gets older. So that gave me at least some boundaries on how old it could be, and it's clearly pre-dynastic. that then brings up for many people, well, who could be building it? Because by conventional thinking, the people that were living in Egypt, if there were people living in Egypt, initially people told me there weren't even people in Egypt at that time that could do it. You know, it's pre-Egyptian civilization, pre-dynastic period. Many people jump immediately to the concept of Atlantis and this concept of advanced civilization way back in what is conventionally thought of as prehistory that was building things. Some people have said the Atlanteans built the Great Pyramids. That's a popular story that you find in certain realms of literature going back at least 100 years. Other people, you know, or the people jumped on my conclusion saying that this proves Atlantis or proves that the Atlanteans built the Sphinx and therefore the pyramids, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a bit of a stretch.
I always thought it was a bit of a stretch.
Right.
It's nothing I was ever saying. What I am saying is that the Sphinx goes back to pre-dynastic times. We have to rethink exactly what was happening on the Giza Plateau and elsewhere in Egypt at a very early period. And I think we're finding more and more evidence of that. Since I did my initial Sphinx work, for instance, evidence has been coming out that other structures on the Giza Plateau may in fact be older. Something that's known as the Kent Kaus tomb, or the tomb of Kent Kaus, which is a 4th dynasty tomb. It's very clear at this point, looking at it, that it in fact incorporates an older structure, just as the Sphinx is an older structure, essentially, that was then incorporated in 2500 BC into a larger architectural plan as they reworked the site. If you go to southern Egypt, for instance, and this has come out since my initial work on the Sphinx, some people may have heard of the so-called calendar circles that occur in Nabta Playa, have only in the last 10 years or so really been recognized for what they are, which is a very old structures similar to Stonehenge, but not as charismatic, should we say, because the stones aren't as large, they aren't as nicely worked. But going back to the same period, clearly, that I'm talking about 5,000 plus BC, in some cases maybe even 10,000 plus BC, and demonstrating incredibly sophisticated stellar, solar, lunar alignments. You know, sophistication and technology, at least astronomical ability, that no one suspected at such an early age anywhere in the world. And so, in my opinion, we continue to find these things, which ties in with the general theme that essentially people were more sophisticated at earlier age, at earlier time period, than, you know, traditional archaeology, traditional history would acknowledge.
Now, did you get into a lot of conflict with Egyptologists and historians over this?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have spoken to many different types of groups on this, presented my research at different conferences. Initially, I presented at Geological Society of America. Everyone there thought it was great. It was fellow geologists. They understood what I was talking about. They understand erosion. They understand weathering. They understand dating rocks. They understand seismic work. And they thought it was wonderful. They, you know, I got nothing but adulation, should we say. My scariest thing there was a friend of mine. He came up and I was showing him the data before I gave the actual presentation. He started laughing. And I was, you know, being nervous or something. I thought I'd made some horrible mistake. And he said, no, he was laughing because it was so straightforward. Why hadn't anyone noticed this before? So that was one reaction. The other reaction, the other extreme, is when I would go to Egyptological conferences, and Egyptologists want nothing to do with this. They wanted to hear nothing about it. It had to be wrong. They didn't want to look at the data. I literally had one Egyptologist, to paraphrase him, and I don't even know who it was, because, you know, at that time I was not that savvy on who was who in the Egyptological world. I was just a geologist. But basically say to the effect that he didn't understand the data. He didn't know what it was. He couldn't refute it, but he knew it was wrong. End of story. And then I had another one who came up to me and said discreetly to me after a talk I gave, he said, you know, there are lots of rocks in the world. Why don't you go play with some other rocks?
Right, right.
And I didn't know if it was a joke or a threat or what. I think it was more the latter.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I got very, very different receptions. And then, and I don't want to sound the wrong way about anyone, because I don't hold any grudges against anyone, et cetera. But then I'll go to other conferences, and all this persists to a certain extent to this very day, although I find that, the support among my fellow geologists has never wavered. When I talk to Egyptologists or Egyptological circles, they're finding more and more I'm not going away. They have to address the data. Even to the point that some Egyptologists now are saying, well, you know, maybe Shaq is a little bit right. Maybe the Sphinx actually belongs to Khufu, the pharaoh before Khafre. It's like they're just giving me a little bit.
Wow, it's amazing they gave you that much.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it also helps that two other geologists have now gone over there, Colin Reeder, who's a British geologist, and David Coxhill, who's also a British geologist, and they don't know each other, or they didn't until they both got involved in this, and neither one knew me beforehand, but they both went over there. I am certain they went over there, because I know how academics work, to find my fatal flaw. Then they can publish an article saying why I am wrong, you know, Shaq is wrong, and that makes a nice article. But in both cases, they confirmed my basic observations, even extended them.
So when they look at the empirical data, there's not too much they can say against
exactly,
your data.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I know that a couple of Egyptian geologists have also done that. This is now off the record, unfortunately, because they have not felt that they could say anything very publicly, being in Egypt and the Egyptian government having a vested interest, should we say, in the traditional dating, or at least feeling they do. Put it this way, there's been no one, in my opinion, who has refuted me on scientific grounds. There have been some geoarchaeologists who clearly have a vested interest in the traditional dating and have come up with the most bizarre ad hoc hypotheses to explain away the data, which, you know, without going into a lot of technicalities, it just doesn't work.
Doesn't fizzle out.
Yeah, I mean, you can always make up, you know, weird theories that are... Well, I'll give you an example of another friend of mine. He was saying this in jest. He said, clearly the problem is that you didn't take into account that for the last 3,000 to 4,000 years, there was a black cloud that always sat over the Sphinx and rained just on it. I mean, he was joking, obviously.
Right.
But I mean, some of the theories to try to refute my data are literally just as ridiculous.
So would you just see this as people who are just too stubborn to change their paradigm?
Or? No, I think it's not just stubbornness. I think that there are a lot of people out there with a real vested interest in their own paradigm. And I wanted to mention the opposite extreme. I also will go to conferences when I'm invited sometimes. I'll go to conferences that, how should we say, the people there are very much invested in, for instance, a belief in Atlantis, and
right.
It's maybe what I would call, and I don't mean to be derogatory, but sort of a pseudo-religious belief in such things. Or, you know, that sometimes it used to be people use the term New Age. I don't know if people still use that term.
It's still around, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, so they're coming there, they want to hear what I say, and they're going the other extreme. Not only is everything I'm saying right, but, you know, they want to take it way beyond where I'm talking, you know, and fit it into their worldview. Just like when I speak to certain Egyptological groups, they want to dismiss absolutely everything I say because it doesn't fit into their worldview. My point is that I see a lot of people taking what I say and either accepting or rejecting it to various degrees, not based on the actual data analysis and what I would consider worthy interpretation of the analysis, but based much more on their worldview, how they see things. that makes sense.
Yes, it certainly does. It's very clear. And just to expand a little bit now, in your book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders,
mm-hmm.
What direction do you go in that book?
Well, where I go in that book is that something I became very interested in, looking at these ancient, you know, the Sphinx got me to think about, seriously, the beginning of civilization, the beginning of what we might call high culture, and whether the traditional view that civilization basically begins in the 4th millennium B.C. at the earliest in both Egypt at the very end of the 4th millennium, about 3,100 B.C., and in Mesopotamia, the so-called Fertile Crescent, Sumeria, that region, where unfortunately we have a horrible war right now, Iraq.
Right, yeah.
You know, but again, in the 4th century B.C., that the tradition is that that's where high civilization begins. In the old world, it seems to blossom independently much later in the New World, in the Americas, you know, maybe has an independent development, ironically, about the same time in the 4th millennium B.C. in China, or at least Asia. And, you know, this is what I learned as undergraduate. This is what's in all the standard textbooks and history books and even popular books. And so I started looking at this, becoming more and more interested in the very beginnings of civilization and what we might call sophisticated culture. And, you know, if the Sphinx pokes a hole in it, are there other things that poke a hole in it? And what I've been finding is that, you know, I'm convinced that the standard story may be the standard story, but it's not necessarily based on the best analysis of the data that we have at hand. What I believe at this point, based on the data, and I'm willing to change my beliefs as the data changes or we get more data, but sure looks to me like civilization, not just in Egypt, but around the world, goes back a bit further than we've been led to believe. Unfortunately, as you go back in time, and I know this as a geologist, as you go back in time, the amount of data that is preserved exponentially drops off. And you have to take that into account. But that doesn't mean that you dismiss what data has survived as simply an anomaly that, you know, you find something, a couple of items in situ in good context, I think you have to take that data into account. And too many times that has not been the case, it seems.
What do you think of Mohenjo-Daro, for example?
I've been there years ago. It's incredibly interesting. There you have a very sophisticated culture in the Indus region. You know, essentially, by conventional dating, a little bit too early, but I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. What I've actually become more and more interested in is that in ancient times, pre-Columbian times, and even, you know, quite ancient times, there seems to have been not only civilization earlier than a lot of people suggest, but more interesting to me personally is there seems to have been a fair amount of global contact at a very early period, which is a very different scenario than what I learned as an undergraduate. Most people learned that, for instance, to take the extreme, civilization in the Americas arose totally independently and isolated from civilization in the Old World.
Right. Now, there seems to be various connections between, say, Central America and Egypt, pyramid building.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I started with those types of things, you know, the obvious, because I was involved in Egypt, or am involved in Egypt to this day, and started to look at pyramids in Egypt. Well, where else do you find in the world pyramids? Turns out you find them in a lot of places, including, you know, the most, in terms of number of pyramids, the most pyramids are found in Mesoamerica and, you know, essentially Mexico on down. That's where you find more pyramids than anywhere else in the world. And my initial instinct was, well, this has something to do with Egypt. Actually, I think the connection, or the primary connection, is a little more circuitous. It seems to go from Egypt into Asia, China in particular, and then across the Pacific was the strongest element of dispersal, if we could use that term. So, for instance, there are incredible number of legends in ancient China, from ancient Chinese literature, about people crossing, or at least going east across what we now call the Pacific, and in some cases never coming back. In some cases, there are legends of them coming back and reporting, lands to the east of them, etc., etc. We also find, and a lot of people don't have a good sense of this, because China has been such a closed society for the last century and longer, but there are an incredible number of pyramids in China.
Oh, really? You don't hear anything about
that? No, you
that.
Don't. Yeah. You don't. I illustrate a few in Voyages of Pyramid Builders with some photos I was able to get, but in fact, the Chinese to this day, they're a very closed society. They don't emphasize this. There's been a lot of suggestions, and I'm not making accusations, but a lot of suggestions that, in fact, they're trying to downplay this, even destroy them. They traditionally, in the last century, had different approach, should we say, to their ancient forebears than some people do.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Kind of hard.
Yeah, exactly. But, you have an incredible number of pyramids in China. And then the earliest pyramids that you get, for instance, the Olmec pyramids that we know well in the Americas, in fact, are very much built along a Chinese pattern. Style, yeah. And it gets better than that. There are, for instance, implements. They're called celts. They're ceremonial sort of hand axe type structures carved out of various stones, including jade. And I don't want to go into great detail here, but just the fact of using jade is something that's very common, for instance, in the Americas and China. But not just that they were using jade, but there are these Celts or Celts, depending on how you like to pronounce it, that have been found in good archaeological context back in the 1950s. In particular, a set of them sort of buried as and apparently in some kind of ritualistic or a sacrifice context. But a good burial, well documented, they were found, and they had these scratchings on them, for lack of a better term. And people argue, could this be some kind of primitive writing, or could this be decoration, incised decoration, or is it just scratchings? Nothing. And people will argue this back and forth. Relatively recently, they've been looked at by not American specialists, because up until, recently, people outside of the Americas, they wouldn't mess with American archaeology because everyone knew that there was no connection with the old world anyway.
Right, right.
But recently they've been looked at experts from China who know ancient Chinese ideographs, ancient Chinese writing, and they can read them.
Oh, wow. They know what's been said. That's amazing.
And
wow.
It actually talks about Shang Dynasty ancestors and whatnot, ancestor worship. I mean, now how do you explain that if there wasn't actual contact?
And you don't actually see any of this in, any of the academic journals?
No, of course not. This is absolutely anathema. I mean, people don't talk about this stuff, but it's real. And then it gets really bad when people start resorting to, it's all a hoax and someone planted it there, which is just total nonsense when you've got an untouched archaeological site that was excavated by, well-known experts who had no clue as to what they were finding. And it's not like someone came out of the woodwork the next day and tried to make a stink about it, which is what you expect if it were a hoax.
Well, sure. They'll always bring up Piltdown Man, which has nothing to do
It has nothing to do with anything. I mean, if you were going to dismiss every science and every field of study that's had its hoax,
right? You'd be gone.
There'd be nothing left because every field has had, unfortunately, people who have hoaxed things. Give you another quick example, which is actually from the Atlantic. And it's a later issue or a later artifact. But in a pre-Columbian site in Mexico, there was found a little head. And this was, again, good context. It was late period pre-Columbian site, but definitely pre-contact, found in good context, a little, like, you know, pottery terracotta head, which is clearly not a Mexican head. It's a Greco-Roman head.
Oh, my, kind of like on the idea of Kennewick Man? Or,
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a little, but this is a little pottery. Not,
oh, right. Oh, yeah. It's a shape thing.
Yeah, it's a little sculpted thing.
Right.
But
right.
It's very clear. I mean, you know, any expert in Greco-Roman art, they wouldn't think twice if it had been found in, you know, Egypt or Italy or, you know, anywhere in the Middle East that the Romans controlled, or Spain even, et cetera. But it's absolutely out of context.
Oh, sure,
in,
yeah.
In a New World situation. And it was found actually in a very late pre-Columbian context as a burial offering. And the head itself has been dated by thermoluminescence, which confirms that it's, you know, somewhere, say, 200 AD, which is stylistically what it looks like, too, and all the, you know, the pottery it's made of is right, that's Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera. And what I would suggest, at least, is that this is probably something that crossed over somehow, because there was, I'm convinced, on basis of lots of evidence, that there was transatlantic as well as transpacific contact. Some of it may have been somewhat ephemeral. That is, what I mean by that is that, you know, some cases people blown off course, not necessarily doing it purposefully.
Sure.
But there was clearly contact, and there was clearly influence and ideas crossing and pollination, if you would, between, you know, the old world and the new world. And in this case, this may have been something that was carried over, whether it was purposefully or not, and then, you know, highly revered for hundreds of years, passed down before it ended up as, you know, an offering, where it was not just an offering of a little clay head, but an offering of what even they, you know, probably acknowledged as sort of an artifact.
Sure, yeah,
value.
Yeah.
So, but again, you know, good physical evidence, in my opinion, of cross-cultural
pre-Columbian contact
across the oceans.
Wow.
Which, you know, again, is anathema. You're not allowed to talk about stuff like that. And to me, this is just one more line of thought, just like talking about a very old Sphinx, and that there could be civilization, so to speak, before civilization. I think we need to look at the evidence and really, you know, consider these possibilities, and when we start to consider them, we get a very different view of our predecessors.
Mm, very good. Now, what is your next project? What are your future projects?
Oh, well, right now I have a book coming out. We're talking in January 2005, and I have a book that should be out this summer, and that focuses on the Great Pyramid. That, in some ways, is a continuation of my previous books, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, and before that, Voices of the Rocks. And in this new book, it's called Pyramid Quest, I focus specifically on the Great Pyramid, and I do, in some ways, for the Great Pyramid, what I do for the Sphinx, which is I look at it, my conclusion after analyzing all the data, and I've been in and through the Great Pyramid many times, had a chance to go up into chambers no one normally gets access to. My conclusion is that the Great Pyramid is not of a single piece either. I think that the earliest portions of it go back to pre-dynastic times, that it was then older structures were incorporated into later structures. The culmination of the Great Pyramid was 4th Dynasty, Khufu, about 2550 BC, but he was clearly building on something that was a much earlier structure. And I don't think it's a terribly radical view when you start to think about it. I mean, we have it throughout Europe, throughout Egypt itself, many places where you have a sacred site, something's built there, then something
sure,
is built on top.
Sure, cathedrals are built
of
on top, I'm sure.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So I think exactly the same thing was happening with the Great Pyramid, and I think specifically the subterranean chamber of the Great Pyramid is, you know, an incredibly ancient structure going back I believe, to pre-dynastic times. And I think this ties, you know, again, I think we're building up a more comprehensive picture. It wasn't just a Sphinx city in isolation. Either on the Giza Plateau or in the world at large, there was more going on at an earlier point.
Could you give us your web address?
Sure. It's www.robertschoch, which is RobertSchoch, all one word, .net, N-E-T. So www.robertschoch, all one word, .net.
And you'll have updates on when your books are coming out,
yes,
and everything.
Yes, of course. I want to repeat again. People always misspell my last name. It's S-C-H-O-C-H. It's not the way it sounds.
Right, but you have a certain shock effect in the academic.
Exactly.
Okay.
So many people have made. It's fine.
Right.
I'm a geologist. I'm a geophysicist. I can deal with shocks.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I'll keep things updated. Right now, I'm planning to, I hope if all goes well, get back to Egypt again to continue the research, you know, because all of this is ongoing. I'm expanding right now into other aspects of ancient Egypt, and when I say ancient Egypt, my real interest is very ancient Egypt,
right,
you know,
right.
The boundary between dynastic and pre-dynastic and earlier. So I want to expand this, this work well beyond the Giza Plateau outside of Cairo. I've been spending time looking at temples and other sites in other parts of Egypt, you know, up and down the Nile, and again, you know, every site, we can confirm that goes back to very, very ancient times. A lot was going on at a much earlier period. You know, so many Egyptologists, they focus on New Kingdom Egypt, for instance, which is understandable.
It's interesting.
It's a glorious period. You got Tutankhamun, King Tut. You know, got all kinds of exciting things going on. But that.